Everybody, welcome to the House State Affairs Committee. Will you please call the roll?
Representative Hughes.
Here.
Representative Millet.
Here.
Representative Isaacson.
Here.
Representative Lynn.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Gaddis.
Here.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Here.
Go on, everybody, and thank you for coming in, and thanks to the audience for being out there today, and those who are going to testify. Today, we intend to hear two bills, HB1, which is appropriate since it's the first bill of the state affairs, and regarding driver's license, we're going to hear HB 52 on PFD allowable absences. And so with that, I'd like to bring up HB1 as the first bill for consideration. I need to have a CS, I mean committee substitute. I would request somebody to introduce that.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move HB number one version uniform the CS to as our working document.
Okay, is there an objection for discussion? Objection for discussion. Mr. Vice Chair.
Oh, no objection.
Well, so. for discussion.
For discussion purposes.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
You want to explain?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. My staff, as far as Wolf, will explain the difference between the original and the committee substitution.
Right. So, for the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, staff for Representative Bob Lynn. We just wanted to take out the phrase by mail and because we're wanting those fees to be waived for people renewing their driver's licenses. In all facets, so by mail, in person, and hopefully in the future online.
Okay, and we can get into that a little further and get to further testimony. Yeah, please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, staff for Representative Bob Lynn.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I'd like to tell you that this bill simply enables the Department of Motor Vehicles, the DMV, to issue a driver's license for a period of less than 5 years for someone who has a legal presence in the United States for less than 5 years. The way it is today, somebody with a visa, a visitor to the United States that expires in 2 weeks can walk into a DMV and get a driver's license that doesn't expire for 5 years. This bill simply links the duration of the driver's license to the duration of the visa or any other legal presence document. I think that's just plain common sense. If the legal presence document is for some indefinite or provisional period of time, like, for example, a refugee or someone seeking asylum, the driver's license could be issued for 1 year, but could be renewed every year for a period up to 5 years at no additional expense. Similar legislation has been passed in many other states, and your favorable consideration of this bill is respectfully requested. And with that, I'd like to ask my staffer, Forrest Wolf, to explain further. Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Representative Led. To the chair, members of the committee. Sorry.
We got to keep these guys straight over there.
Okay. Determining how long a foreign national is legally allowed to stay in the United States is the purview of the Department of Homeland Security, not the state of Alaska. We should not be issuing official or legal documentation that outlasts a person's legal presence in the U.S. House Bill 1 simply enables the DMV to issue a driver's license for less than 5 years, so that a visitor's license expires at the same time as their visa or other authorized length of stay document. This bill reflects what is considered best practice by the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. Currently, 36 other states, as well as the District of Columbia, have these similar policies in statute or regulation. Alaska DMV already requires a new applicant for a driver's license to prove legal presence, as is the case in all but four other states. House Bill 1 merely fine-tunes existing law to ensure that a driver's license reflects the documentation that is currently submitted to the DMV. This bill also allows an international visitor to renew their license without any additional fee if their visa or legal presence document is extended for a period of up to 5 years. This is the same length of time as it is for nearly all Alaskans. These renewals can be done in person, by mail, and hopefully soon via the internet. This ensures these visitors won't be incurring any extra fees that other Alaskans aren't. In the rare instance a visitor has a provisional, pending, or indefinite length of stay, they will renew their license every year, again with no additional fees. We wanted this legislation to be as simple as possible. That's why we specifically left out state ID cards from this legislation. The DMV already has the authority to issue state ID cards for less than 5 years. It does not have the same authority for driver's licenses. Once again, this bill does not change how people currently obtain a driver's license. The documentation requirements and verification procedures currently in use will remain in place. Also, there is no requirement in this bill that people present any immigration documentation as proof of ID when applying for a driver's license. However, if a person does use these documents, then the DMV would consider the expiration date. This bill is essentially the same version of a bill that passed the House last session by a vote of 33-2 with 5 excused absences. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have as best I can. I also have Director Amy Erickson and Deputy Director Shelley Malott of DMV here, as well as Assistant Attorney General Erling T. Johansson online, available for presentations and questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Wolf? Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, this may be for DMV, but does the DMV now currently renew driver's license in any form by mail? And please explain.
Introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
And to expand that, so it isn't just a yes or no, but what standards are used for verifying, you know, that it's a right person?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I'd actually...
And bring the microphone closer to you, please.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I'd actually like for Shelley Malott to answer those questions. She knows.
Currently, the DMV will renew one time through mail every other renewal you can renew through mail. We use the old photo. They go online and they do some eligibility. They take the information off their current issued license or ID card. That hits our system when they plug it in to see if they're eligible to renew by mail. And if so, then they will go through the process, print out the form, sign it, mail it into DMV, and then we'll process the and mail the license back to them.
Any follow-up?
Okay, a follow-up on this. If this law were to pass, then are you presuming that there would be regs put out, like the verification, for example, of the time of the authorized stay would have to be emailed or mailed in or signed or something? You know, I mean, you have none of that is in place, right? And is it in follow up on that, there's no statutory standards right now, right, for that. It would be something developed by the division.
Through the chair, Representative Keller. Yes, we would have to develop some regulations on what documents they would need to send to us through the mail, copies of documents, in order to extend the expiration date on that license.
Thank you.
Can you follow? Representative Isaacson and then Representative Gaddis.
Thank you. I actually have several questions then, and just to follow up what Rep. Keller was asking, if I heard you right, Ms. Malott, you were saying that currently is a holder of an Alaska driver's license can simply renew it by mail using the existing information on the document, and you just basically send them authorization that it's renewed. If I remember right, when I was in school, I was sent a little strip that I just put on top of my driver's license.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, it's a little bit more advanced now. I mean, you actually have to input the information off the last document that's issued to you. It verifies against our computer system to verify your identity. And then it goes through a process to verify your eligibility after that. And if you meet both those criteria, then the document, you finish completing the document online, you print it out, currently sign it, mail it into the division with your payment, and then we issue the document, we issue a new card. We don't send stickers anymore like we used to. So issue a new card with your last photo on file, and then mail it back to you.
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and perhaps this is for staff, then if the intent of this is to allow the department to issue less than 5 years a license, and the secondary intent, I take it, is to not allow an illegal immigrant to have a document that says that they're legal in Alaska, how is this going to fulfill the second part? If for example, I could be anywhere in the world, and if I want to say I've got a legal way of being in Alaska with a driver's license, let's say, because that's a legal document, I take it, I could just request an extension, but not necessarily show proof, and this goes back to what Rep. Keller was asking, I suppose. I don't have to show proof that my legal presence documents actually allows me to be here, but the fact that I have a license, I can just renew it without question. Is it? Am I on target?
Yes and no. We would just need to develop some regulations that would require somebody that has a license that is issued for a period of less than 5 years to submit proof of the extension of their legal presence at the time of renewal. So they could, you know, send us copies of their extension documents with their application from that are issued by immigration. We'd have to have something to show if you're not being issued a 5-year license, then obviously it's because of your legal presence. And so we would need to just develop regulations showing or listing what they'd have to submit to us in order to renew by mail in another form besides in person.
Representative?
Thank you. To follow up on that then, so does this bill actually dictate to you to do that? Because there's some ambiguity about that. That's the first part of that question. And then the second, would that be considered discriminatory because we're not asking any other class of license holder to submit proof of legal presence?
This bill gives us the authority to adopt regulations to carry out this statute. So as far as discriminatory, I mean, Erling's on the phone, our attorney. Maybe he could answer that. So,
I was going to ask you, what does the DMV do now with those same kind of documents?
We look at them initially. I mean, we look at them every day. And anytime somebody's coming to get an original license, but once they get an original license, they never have to show them to us again. Right. It's not uncommon for people to come into the DMV and have documents that, especially they're here on tourist visas, or have documents that are valid documents to obtain a license, but they would expire 2 weeks. Even if they walked in today and they expired tomorrow, they're valid documents today. So we would issue to them based on that. So
they came in today, but something expires tomorrow, they get the license for 5 years.
Correct.
That, to me, that doesn't make sense. That's why we have the bill. Representative Gaddis.
And I guess one of my questions was, how many driver's licenses are issued to folks with visas on a yearly basis here in the state?
I don't know that we have that, through the chair, Representative Gaddis. I don't know that we have that. I don't have that number. Uh-huh. But there's quite a large, and I don't know that we necessarily document our records in a way that we could answer that today.
Would you suppose it'd be a few, several, many?
Several a day.
Okay.
So. Several a day,
yes.
of this type throughout,
yes,
the state. Okay. Representative Millett.
Thank you. Ms. Millett, so what this bill in essence would do with the visa expiration date would be the expiration date of the driver's license. Yeah. That's all we're doing, is issuing a driver's license based on what their visa or their whatever their immigration status is. So the expiration date of their driver's license would be the expiration date of their legally being in the U.S., correct?
Correct.
Okay.
No more than all that. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did receive some material about some concern about DMV reviewing the federal documentation, but it sounds like already you see that kind of paperwork coming through. Can you talk to us about those documents and how clearly you're able to pick up those dates? Is there just a limited number of documents that you see, and the expiration dates are very clear.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, our staff goes through extensive fraudulent document training. We see those documents every day. We deal with those documents every day now. And there's a wide variety of them. So that's issued by the Immigration Service. So this is, from the DMV side, nothing would change to what we do every day today except the expiration date that's on that license. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Representative Gaddis.
I do have one last question, I think.
You can have all the questions you want.
Okay, thanks. How does this affect the international driver's license?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis. There is no effect. I mean, the international driver's license is somebody taking their overseas license and getting it translated into English and driving here on that, which they can still do. So
if I could follow up,
please. Yes, follow up, please.
So even if they had a visa that expired tomorrow and they had an international driver's license that was 5 years, they could continue on with that. Could they use that international driver's license to get an Alaska driver's license?
No.
Okay.
We don't accept that as a form of documentation.
And I've had an international driver's license myself on occasion. Mm-hmm. I forget, is it that for 6 months or a year, do you recall?
Mr. Chairman, I do not recall. We don't issue those, so we don't really get involved.
Yeah, I know. Do you get one?
Goes through like AAA.
Last one I got, I went down to AAA, and
AAA,
I paid $20 or somewhere in that neighborhood. And I think it's for 6 years, but I wouldn't.
They take your document and translate it into a language for the country that you're going to.
I know I was in the military in Germany.
Yeah.
I had my, of course, my United States license. But also had an international driver's license, and I could drive any place. Yeah. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a long time since I got that original license. I won't say how many years, but I'm trying to remember. Is there any question on there about a person's legal status, citizenship, on the original application?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there is a question, I think, that asks if you're a U.S. citizen, but it really has to do with voting. Because we collect voter registration information, but no. I mean, we know because of the documents that you present us. If you're a U.S. citizen, you're going to present us with for your original license, a U.S. Birth certificate or a U.S. passport, or a naturalization certificate or...
Any follow-up?
Yes, thank you. So I'm thinking this goes back to Representative Isaacson's concern. So those folks that currently have the five-year licenses who have already expired past their expiration date as far as when they should be here, they could apply by mail. And based on the fact that they had a prior license, would there be anything that would be red flagged on your end from their original application where they indicated no, that they were not a U.S. citizen, so that then you would request additional documentation?
We do collect place of birth. So, I mean, we could, you know, we could verify, because we have that information on records, place of birth, so which to then ask for additional information.
Can you continue, please?
Do you foresee that might be part of the regulations that you develop, that you would indeed, if they had a birthplace outside of the United States or did not mark that they were a U.S. citizen, that rather than them simply being able to renew that, you know, five-year license they have in hand, that you would request additional information?
We definitely could have put that into our regulations to allow us to ask for that information again.
So. Continue.
And thank you. Do you know, do other states follow that method?
Many states, after they passed their legal presence bill, had anyone they could identify as a non-U.S. original citizen basically re-up, you know, come in and show their documents again. So. to, one, see if they have naturalized at that point or gotten a, you know, permanent resident card or were still in a status of temporary visitor or didn't have valid documents to be in the U.S.
Right.
And so just to be clear, your expectation is then that rather than automatically reissuing a five-year license that someone who is not a U.S. citizen, that you would be requesting additional information as other states have done. You expect that that will be part of the process.
I would think that would be a best practice on our part.
Yeah. I'd like to reiterate that the only thing this bill does is fix it so you guys can issue a license for some period less than 5 years if there's reason to do so. You can do, so this bill has nothing whatsoever to do with legal presence other than the date. Am I correct, Nan?
Yes.
So this doesn't change any policy whatsoever about who gets the license. The only thing it does is change the expiration date. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That whole other thing is another issue, yeah. Right? Okay. Any other questions? Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I should hold off on this question for after public testimony.
Right. And we're going to be hearing from the director, whatever she'd like to say. We'll be hearing also from the Assistant Attorney General, I believe, is here.
Okay. To clarify what you had just said and the intent, and noting that there's sometimes a disconnect between our expectations and then when actually the rules of are formulated and adopted, and then the future interpretation, if there's some ambiguity. What I don't understand is how effective this can be in providing you the ability of doing less than 5 years a driver's license if, say, as a possessor of a document that allows me to be here for 2 years, at the 2 year point, I just simply renew by mail or something or over the internet, and I have a 5 year, and with no requirement to verify my presence or my legal standing, to get that. That's the part I don't understand. If we're actually accomplishing anything, if we have an automatic renewal type clause.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, it's like I said, it does the. It currently under statute, we have no ability to issue any license for less than 5 years, unless it's a temporary license, which is only issued to those that like are pending administrative hearing type issues. This at least gives us the ability to look at adopting regulations on for to issue licenses that for some reason should have an expiration date of less than 5 years.
But they
go ahead.
They still could be renewed, though.
Correct.
And so circumvent the original purpose of having less than 5 years.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson.
Identify yourself, please.
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, staffer, Boplin. In your scenario, someone's legal presence document that expires in 2 years, then their driver's license would also expire at the end of that 2 years. They would need to provide some sort of new information that shows that their legal presence has either been extended or renewed. I think what you're getting a little bogged down in is the people that are in what we call provisional or pending or temporary status. These are people that are maybe seeking some sort of political asylum where the Department of Homeland Security is actually continuously reviewing their cases and hasn't given them a definite termination date for their legal presence in the United States. And that's where people are being able to renew their driver's licenses by mail. Or in person, or hopefully soon via the internet. Does that answer your question a little further?
So you're saying that if I have a student visa, let's say, and it's just for 2 years and it expired, there'd be some indication that would say that it was as a result of a visa or?
Exactly. To my understanding, that's what would happen. Correct. Is that your student visa, whatever document expires in 2 years, so does your driver's license. In order then to renew that driver's license, you need to provide some sort of other documentation that shows that your legal presence or student visa or what have you has also been extended.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Ms. Enner, I'd like to welcome you, by the way, to your new position, Director of the DMV.
Thank you.
And every time I've had occasion to go to the DMV, I've had a very, very pleasant experience. In some places I've been, not in Alaska, it's been something akin to going to the dentist. But up here, it's been a very good experience, and I'm sure you're going to help keep it that way.
Thank you.
Yeah. Would you like any comments, follow up?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think that you have discussed all the items that I had in my statement, so I'm just available for questions.
Okay. Any questions for the DMV director? Okay. I'd like to thank you very much. Please hang around here. We may have some more. Representative Millett.
Thank you. Does DMV have a position on this bill? Do you support this bill? Are you neutral on this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, we do support this bill.
Thank you.
Okay. And it's a zero fiscal note, I'm happy to report. And I failed to mention that in my opening statement. Thank you very much. Do we have somebody here from Department of Justice?
Law.
Law.
Well, Department of Law, well, hopefully the law is justice.
Hello, this is Erling Giant, Department, Assistant Attorney General.
Somebody here in Department of Law?
Online.
Okay, online. Are you on there, sir?
Yes,
ma'am.
Chairman.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is Erling Johansson, Assistant Attorney General here in Anchorage.
Thank you. Would you make any comments you'd care to make on HB1?
Representing the DMV, I see no constitutional issues with this bill. I did a quick check on a research check with legal presence and driver's license. I found no cases across the country that had challenged this. This is not a matter of driver license denial. These applicants, these motorists, would get a license consistent with the term of their authorized stay. This is not a bill that challenges the federal government's right to regulate immigration. The DMV's activities based on this bill follow the federal determinations. And those are my comments, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments from the committee? Anybody? You got off easy, sir.
Thank you.
We may think of something yet, so please stick around. Anybody else online that would like to testify? Nobody else online? Anybody in the room who would like to testify? Okay, with that, I'm going to close public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion. Should we go down the line? Anything, Reverend Christ Tompkins?
No comments or questions.
Okay, Reverend Gaddett?
No, thank you.
And Reverend Hughes?
I'm good, thank you.
Reverend Millett? Reverend Isaacson? No, I know who you are.
Yes.
Vice Chair Keller.
No questions. I'd like to move.
I'll remove my objection to adopting the CS.
Oh, thanks.
Good idea.
Get it rusty getting started again. I'm glad it's a little informal. I'd like to move HB 1 LS0008 uniform out of committee with accompanying zero fiscal note and individual recommendations, and also a comment that this also goes to judiciary and we'll get another look at it if there's questions that arise.
And without objection, and the bill is moved. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I want to thank you. Folks who testify here today, this is my staffer's first presentation of a bill, and you keep your job.
All right.
And I also thank the Department of Law and everybody who's here. And so we're taking Eddie while we do the paperwork. going to consider is House Bill 52, an act relating to allowable absences from the state for purpose of eligibility for government fund, permanent fund dividends, providing for an effective date. And we're going to go a little bit of out of order here to accommodate a gentleman from Okinawa, Japan. And are you online, Mr. Ross? Mr. Ross, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Speak up just a little bit. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and make whatever comments you'd like about this bill.
My name is Brian Ross, and I'm a lifelong Alaska resident. And I'm not sure if many members of the committee received my letter in support of House Bill 52. But I've been working on trying to fight the 10-year rule as it applies to PFDs and Alaska military, career military personnel for a long time now with a series of appeals and then also court cases through the all the way up to the Alaska Supreme Court recently that was actually continued to deny my appeal to receive a dividend despite my extended absence. And so I'm hoping that my personal story that I provide along with some thoughts about how this particular statute, the 10-year rule, unfairly penalizes those in the military will help convince you to support House Bill 52.
Yeah, are you on active duty, sir? Are you on active duty, sir?
I'm sorry, sir?
Are you on active duty in the military?
Sir, I am. I also just want to be able to point out that the testimony that I provide today is no way endorsed by the Department of Defense or constitutes an endorsement by the Marine Corps. I mean, I'm testifying as a private citizen, too.
Fine. I'd like to thank you for your service, sir. Okay, any questions for Mr. Ross?
Thank you, sir.
Question, Mr. Ross? If not, thank you very much and carry on. Okay. Representative Foggy, would you like to make opening comments, post-opening comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Eric Foggy, representing District 6. House Bill 52 actually went most of the way through the process in the previous legislature as House Bill 190.
It's for HB.
2 years ago, we got all of the members of the legislature got an email from a fellow named Lieutenant Commander Tico Crowfoot. And
a little louder, please.
Lieutenant Commander Crowfoot is a Navy SEAL and is currently active in the fight against terrorism worldwide. He's an Alaskan, joined the U.S. Navy, got on the teams, and, of course, has been stationed outside Alaska his entire military career. And he was, just like Lieutenant Colonel Ross, who was a Marine in Okinawa, career military, Alaska residents from the start, and they're all running up against what is currently ensconced in statute as a 10-year limitation on receiving a dividend, even if you have an allowable absence away from the state. Because we can't selectively single out a specific class of people to get benefits or the other. We can't just say, well, if you're military, you get a particular deal on the permanent fund. What we did with House Bill 52 is we essentially said, we looked at it from the point of view of the intent to return, a person's intent after an allowable absence to come back to the state. And right now, the way the law reads, there's a total of 16 different types of allowable absences. And the basic assumption is that for the first 5 years, the division assumes that you have the intent to return. These allowable absences roughly fall into three different categories: some type of service to the nation or the state in the case of military service, some type of compassionate benefit, compassionate reason, taking care of a sick relative, you're out yourself with some kind of, requiring some kind of medical attention, or you're a spouse of a military member, or an education type absence, you know, kid going to college or something like that. What we're going to try to do with this bill is say after 5 years, the presumption that you are actually, that you intend to return, because it's been over 5 years since you've been in state, you now have to prove that you have the intent to return. And what we've done with the bill is we've taken parts of what is currently regulations and made them statutes, which gives a little more specific direction to administrative law judges who have to process the appeals on these dividend cases. And we've removed the 10-year restriction on the 10-year limit on being able to receive a dividend because of an allowable absence. So that's the general gist of the bill. We feel that this will be fair not only to the individuals, it still retains the allowable absence sort of categories, but it does allow, and this gets back to the original premise for the bill, it does allow someone who makes the decision to pursue a military career to go pursue that career and continue to receive the benefits of being that all Alaska residents and citizens receive in the form of a permanent fund dividend. So at this point, I will pass it over to my staff, Mike Pascal, and he'll take you through the bill step by step.
Very fine. Thank you for your testimony. We're going to call it short at ease for administrative work here. At ease.
Move HB 1 version 28 LS008/Charlie as our working document and make the recent vote on passage of this bill from committee apply to version Charlie.
Okay, without objection. And the previous testimony we heard will apply to this current version. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, Mr. Pascal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael Pascal, staff for Representative Feige, and I, of course, be happy to answer any questions as we go through, but what I'd like to do is step back just a little bit to the progress that allowable absences, or the changes in allowable absences over time, so you just get a little bit of a picture of how allowable absences have been handled by the state since the permanent fund dividend was put in place. As of 1982, the permanent fund dividend had six specific allowable absences, plus the commissioner had the opportunity to grant an allowable absence for any reason that they felt was appropriate through regulation. Going,
go ahead, Tom. I'll get it.
In 1997, there were four different allowable absences added to statute, and that should have said 82. Okay, I'm sorry. I was looking at my years as I was going here. The ability of the commissioner to establish additional absences allowed or remained in statute during this time, and the definition of a state resident was adjusted and incorporated statute from other portions of the Alaska statutes as part of the definition. And that other part of AS0110.055 is shown here on this screen, which is just a standard condition of residency in the state. Okay. Now, as we went to 1998, the statutes were essentially revamped. However, the definition of residency remained essentially the same. Allowable absences were changed significantly in that they were reworded, but most of the allowable absences that were in statute at that time did not actually change in terms of what they allowed. They just rewrote them, presumably to address what had been legal issues, regulation challenges to regulations where they'd been further defined, to better state the intent of the state when it became or when it pertained to the intent of allowable absences. There were also additional items added as allowable absences, including the eligibility of accompanying it with someone that was on an allowable absence. There was also a totally new subsection added that clarified that no one could be absent from the state for more than 180 days unless they were on an allowable absence, one of at that time 12 allowable absences. If the individual is claiming an allowable absence for educational reasons, they can only be absent 120 days outside of the allowable educational absence. So in other words, if a student took a period off for school, for example, a semester, they would have to return to the state or they would lose their permanent fund dividend. Also, if an individual was absent for any of the other allowable absences, when the reason ended, they could only be absent for an additional 45 days. So in other words, someone was out on a medical absence from January through May, then they could only be absent additional 45 days from the state versus the total 180 days. To claim an allowable absence, an individual had to be a resident of the state for 66 consecutive months before leaving the state. Again, this is an addition that occurred prior to 1998. Anyone on allowable absence can only receive an allowable absence for 10 years, except for members of Congress, their staff, and their families. This provision did not impact anyone until after 10 years passed. So its enactment in 1998 may have been for some people noticed, but what it really became noticed was in the 10 years later when it actually impacted someone. What appears to be an unintended consequence from our office's perspective is that someone that is in the military serving our state again loses their permanent fund dividend. And there's the best I've been able to determine, there's only been one individual that actually qualified for the dividend after the 10 years under what is 4323008C. So as we come to 2012, we see essentially the same statute in place for allowable absences with the addition of under part three of serving in the military, actually someone who is a individual's spouse, minor dependent, or a dependent child of an individual in the services and eligible for current fund dividend can receive it. This was, I believe, in result to a court case, but I did not try to research that. again going forward. There was also adding someone who's under coastal articles of employment in the Merchant Marine. Again, most of the other ones remained unchanged. What we also had was three additional allowable absences, including serving as a volunteer in the Peace Corps, training or competing on the Olympic team, or under a student fellowship. So these were again added going into 2012. Our subsection C remained in place at this point. Also, they put in further definition of family member. Under a compassionate absence, a family member can accompany someone, but it had been never defined up till this point. After House Bill 52, which is the bill before you today, all of these sections remain the same as you go through. So there's been no changes in this portion of the bill. Okay. Where the change comes in is as we get into, I'm sorry, I need to back up just one there. Here in this section, you'll notice it goes from B to D under an existing statute because we're removing that one section C that is the 10-year rule. So we're essentially moving that from statute.
Chairman Lynn.
Question, Representative Mellott.
Was it last year or the year before that we added members of Congress and members of Congress family? Because that was a change that happened sometime in the last 2 years. Wasn't that also a change that we had?
Representative Mellett, through the chair, are you asking the exemption to the 10-year rule?
Yes.
That, I believe, was added in I believe it was added in 1998 when the original 10-year rule was put in place.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Okay. So what we've done with the bill now is changed it so that after an individual has been absent from the state for more than 180 days, the state, through the legislature, is now placing in statute a presumption that this individual doesn't intend to return. In other words, you as our legislators, and through enacting this, will be saying it is the intent of this state that if you've been gone for 5 years, you do not intend to return. And that's a change because it's only been done through regulation by the department. And it's been relatively effective on the part of the department to reduce the people that obtain permanent fund dividends over time. But by putting in statute, the department and my conversations with them, as well as our office, believes this will make it more effective. Okay. The individual also has to return to the state for 30 days, again by statute instead of regulation. If they do not return for 30 days over the preceding years, then they will again lose their dividend.
I have a question.
Me. Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you. Why 30 days? Where did that come from?
Representative Keller, through the chair, that came from regulation. That's the existing regulation, is requiring a cumulative 30-day return. And so we didn't choose to make a lot of significant changes from the regulation, but essentially bring them to statute where we felt like they had a stronger stance in court.
So it is 30 days over the 6-year period. Not 30 days a year.
It is not. It's an accumulative 30 days over a preceding number of years. And I'm sorry, it escapes me at the time. We do have the director of the division here that can answer that if you want to know.
Any other questions at this point? Please continue. Oh, excuse me, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. So the 5-year rule is already in place?
Representative.
Or is that being established through the section here?
Representative Eisenson, through the chair, the 5-year rule is in regulation. It is a what is referred to as the 5-year rule. Essentially, what that is, during the original 5 years, there is less requirements to prove your intent to return to the state. Although you still are supposed to prove that, there's really, it's a much lighter requirement. So what we're trying to do is say, by statute, after 5 years, it clearly is not your intent to return. Because most absences after 5 years, you should have had a reason to come back. If you went to school, you should have graduated, for example.
Unless you're in grad school.
And thus, the division would be able to evaluate that and determine that, yes, you're in graduate school, only plan to graduate, versus being a lifelong student and continuing to maintain an absence.
Thank you. Anybody else? Representative Keller.
Another question that I may be getting ahead of you, if you are, just tell me. But in that same subsection, it says the department shall consider, but it doesn't say what they should weigh. You know, I'm on line, page 3, line 23. And I was just wondering, is that, again, just taken from, because it's taken from the regulations? Whether, you know, my question in my mind, of course, is whether or not we should put some weight on, you know, these, you know, so that's.
Representative Keller, through the chair, that's the very next piece I have here.
Oh, I'm
the
sorry.
Okay. That's okay. So that hopefully this will explain it. What we did is essentially, as I say, adopt from regulation. Again, the criteria that the state or that the division currently uses, we did adjust that a little bit to along with the division to try and make it a little stronger. That criteria looks at how long someone's been absent to the state and compared to the length of time they physically were present in the state, both prior to as well as during the absence. For example, someone who lives in the state for 3 years and then absent for 5 years might be a reason to return, but someone that's been absent, that was in the state for 18 years and has been absent for 5 years, there's much stronger ties to the state with the intent to return. Also, the frequency and duration of return trips to the state beyond the minimum 30-day cumulative requirement that you must meet, but how many additional days did you return to the state? Whether the individual is making choices that improve their ability to return to the state versus decisions that keep them out of the state. As for example, what I mentioned to someone that essentially has become a lifelong student is not making career choices to return to the state. Okay, they're making a career out of education. Mm-hmm. Also, an individual would score higher for each of these items that we are establishing in statute that you currently have before you in the presentation and are listed in the bill. For example, if you maintain a home, payment of residential taxes, registration of vehicle, voting history, and that is whether you did or did not vote, not who you voted for, acquisition of a driver's license, a business license, or a professional license, or receipt of benefits and claiming residency in another jurisdiction. The envision that we had in discussion with the division was actually creating a scoring system that the division could use to actually say, this gives you so many points, this removes so many points. And thus, at the end, the determination would be whether or not you would have an intent to return. So that was what was envisioned on that.
Thank you, Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mike, for your packet. It was really thorough. I appreciate it. And the F up there on the slide talks about receipt of benefits under claim of residency in another state. And I'm wondering whether you considered putting any weight as far as the scoring system on someone who has just simply never been a resident of another state. And I'm thinking particularly of those that were born and raised here, because a person could be a resident of another state but could perhaps not have received any benefits. So simply that they were never a resident of another state seems to be something that should be considered, because these folks basically are without a home state in a sense when they hit that 10-year mark under the current law.
Representative Hughes, through the chair. First, I want to clarify one point that is that this isn't residency in Alaska. It's residency for the purposes of a permanent fund dividend. So they don't become a non-resident after 10 years. Okay, it's important to remember that. But essentially, I think what you're looking at here is the criteria that the length of time the individual was absent for the state versus compared to the time they were in the state. And I think the division would have the authority to make ever being a resident of another state a possible criteria. But I think they would also have to look at equal protection clause in the Constitution as to whether or not they could specifically do that. So I would have some concerns discussing it without going to law and getting their opinion on whether or not that would
follow up.
And I did wonder that very same thing, so thank you.
Okay. All right. And two last criteria that addresses primarily employment and career choices, and it essentially provides a little bit of flexibility to the permanent fund dividend and pertaining to they're making decisions with this. So with that being said, that essentially covers everything in the bill. I'd be happy to go through the bill by section, but it is fairly short, but I'd be happy to do that if the chair desires.
Representative Isaacson, and then Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my number five, does the military give the dream list to the state?
I will say that I believe so, or either the individual has to provide some documentation to the permanent fund dividend, but I'll be happy to have the director come up and answer that, or any other questions you have about the division and their procedures.
Thanks. I appreciate the intent of this, and especially because of the unintended consequences that you're trying to limit this, but I'm wondering if we're putting in an expectation by some of our military members that they could have documentation given to them by the DOD that the DOD might not release. So,
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, this is an in regulation existing. Yes, sir, it is. So I don't anticipate that we're creating something through statute, or excuse me, that you're creating something through statute that would cause a problem for the division to verify.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The process to look at this change in legislation occurred because of a contact from military personnel. I'm wondering, is there any other type of area, I'm having trouble thinking of one, that might be impacted by this change that to get beyond that 10-year mark other than military? Can you think of an example?
Representative Hughes, through the chair. I don't want to speculate too hard because what we're evaluating here isn't whether they're on an allowable absence, but whether or not they are likely to return to the state. And so we didn't want to exclude a particular one of the criteria for that purpose. There also were some questions about equal protection under excluding certain ones. However, the Ross Supreme Court case this year did change that a little bit, but we didn't feel like we wanted to go back and make changes to the bill and raise that question.
Follow up.
So am I wrong in assuming that most of the people probably would be military that to which this might apply?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I believe that is correct, that most are likely to be.
Representative Hughes?
Also, I have a question regarding the impact of this on folks who reached that 10-year mark in the past, because I know of some who have. They hit the 10-year mark a while back, but they have maintained everything about their residency just as they were during that 10 years now. Would they be able to apply for the 2013 PFD if this were to pass?
Representative Hughes, to the chair, if you look at Section 4 of the bill, and Section 4 of the bill applies to application for the current permanent fund dividend for certain individuals, and essentially those that are ineligible because of the section we're repealing, which is the 10-year rule, will have 90 days following enactment of the law to apply.
Okay.
And just to clarify, so if they became ineligible, for instance, in 2008, but had they not hit that 10-year mark, they otherwise would be receiving them, they would be eligible during that 90 days to apply and could be found eligible.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, according to my request for the bill drafting from Ledge Legal, that is correct. I don't want to state that it's my opinion, but that was what was asked of Ledge Legal in drafting the bill.
Okay, thank you. And I would just like, Mr. Chair, to make a statement because I am a co-sponsor of this bill, and I did not understand that, and this could result in direct benefit to my adult son, who is active military. He hit his 10-year mark in 2009. So I just, for the record, want to make that clear that I guess I have a conflict, and I didn't realize it.
Thank you very much. And we will have somebody from the alleged legal services available after the testimony here. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Mike, if I could go back to your testimony earlier, you were saying that, and if I understood you correctly, this really has only affected one person that you knew of, or did I hear you wrong?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, the exclusion for members of Congress, their staff, and their families has only applied to one individual.
Okay. And so how many servicemen or women do you anticipate that this is actually affecting?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, the number varies from year to year, but we consider the number of military from the numbers that have been looked at with the division to be slightly over 100.
Okay. Going to, if I may.
Continue.
Going to item six here, whether the individual made a career choice or chose a career path that does not allow the individual to reside, et cetera. Having served in the military myself, I noticed that a lot of folks, when they retire or their last duty station, even though the intent is to go back to the home originating state, you know, they oftentimes retire there. And that's why a lot of us are here in Alaska. Does this allow somebody, by doing this, does this allow us to actually expend more money than we're anticipating to give folks who have the idea that they're coming back another 10 years to collect a permanent fund only to find them retiring at their last duty station and not returning anyway?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, the intent with this was that over time it would become increasingly more difficult to show your intent to return. So an individual, for example, that's been in the military for 18 years should have some reason to return to Alaska and should be able to show that reason. For example, they've bought a retirement home in Alaska or something of that nature. So
home
again,
of record on the military?
Mr. Chair, not just the home of record, but other items. In other words, what are they doing to prove that they plan to attend? Remember, what we're doing is saying, after 5 years, we don't think you're coming back. So what the division would then do is be saying, how can you prove to us you're coming back? So they're essentially setting a different set of criteria. And that criteria now is, prove to us why we should think you're coming back. Because we've already decided you're not. And so that's where the change takes place. So as time progresses, you would have to have a different set of criteria or evaluation on the criteria. If, for example, if they're waiting, and I think the director, Mike, could address that a little more as well.
So if I could follow up.
Follow up, please.
So some states require that you re-register your vehicle in their state. So whereas I was a resident of Washington State, and when I was in the military until I became an Alaska citizen, I kept my Washington plates wherever I went. I became an Alaska citizen. I kept the Alaska plates. This happened to be my last duty station as well, so it didn't matter. But what happens if a service member has the only item that they could prove, since they may not own a home at that time, and they may have had to have their vehicle registered in another state, but they can, I guess, they continue voting or something. Have you looked at, I mean, is this getting too complicated for the division or too subjective for the division to determine intent?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, the desire here was to give the division the opportunity to score these items, because they're already using these items through regulation, most of them, for example, voter registration or vehicle registration. So we're not creating a difficult situation for the division, and hopefully creating something that the division can develop, something that is more objective and less subjective in the evaluation process so that you almost could score yourself ahead of time to know. As to the vehicle registration question, and I believe I'm correct here, is no member of the military on active duty orders is forced to register or change their state of residency.
And the sponsor of the bill, President Feige, is shaking his head in the affirmative.
Although, just to clarify, not change their state of residency, but they may be required to change their vehicle registration while in the state, because that did happen to me one time.
Representative Miller.
So the burden of proof is on the applicant, not, I mean, they are going to be the ones that will have the burden of proof. They, like you said, they can score themselves prior to applying for their dividend. So there's really, the work is done by the applicant to make sure that they understand that there's intent to return to the state of Alaska.
Representative Millett, through the chair, that is correct. The division's responsibility becomes investigating whether or not they're providing false information. So have they falsified documents or something of that nature?
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, I noticed that the fiscal note is zero, and I'm wondering, after 5 years, under all these categories, folks are going to have to prove the things that we've been talking about, and it seems like that might increase the workload of those at the division, because they would be doing their normal application plus providing additional documentation. So just, can you tell us how the fiscal note is zero in that regard? Are they confident that it will not require extensive amounts of time? See, and then how many would that impact roughly on an annual basis of those people that if they don't prove that they'd fall off the rolls as far as eligibility?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, the division is already using most of this criteria, but they sometimes lose on an administrative appeal because it's in regulation, because the administrative law judge says, well, maybe. So the idea here is, again, tightening them slightly, but moving them to statute so that they're stronger in their presence once it goes to an appeal. And I'm not sure the numbers question you're asking, if it's how many people are past the 5 years, mm-hmm. and that's approximately 13,000 in any given year.
Do you have any use follow-up?
Has there been any estimate of how many of those 13,000 might not go to the trouble to do that or might not meet that? I'm just wondering if we'll end up having people that have been collecting under the current law that would fall off the rolls and that might save the state money.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, one of the interesting parts of going through this bill over the previous session and doing the research and asking all the questions is one of the things that you can't determine is what people aren't going to do. And that was the answer to the question we all want to know, is how many people won't qualify, or, for example, the bigger question, how many people actually return to the state? That number we can determine, but we can't determine how many don't return, because we don't know why they don't return. Do they die? Do they simply quit applying before they return, or any of those reasons? So that was one of the big realizations in going through this process.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Gaddis.
I just had a question in regards to clarification. I think it's the next slide back, and it's in regards to item F. And I just want to be clear that what I think I'm reading there is that a military person living in another state could, in fact, become, for, let's say, homestead exemption purposes, a resident of that state, but still qualify for the PFD.
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, if someone takes, for example, the homestead representative or in-state tuition or any other benefits by claiming residency in another state, then they would lose their eligibility.
Okay.
Again, it's weighing the intent to return versus taking advantage of privileges in other states, because the program, the permanent fund dividend, is for qualified residents of our state.
Any follow-up?
And I guess I just want to make a comment. I understand the purpose for this, and I can appreciate it. My husband is an international airline pilot, And there was a time that the PFD was not allowed to him because he's gone for 180 days a year or more. So I appreciate the fact that you're going out there trying to tighten it up for those that are intending to continue being residents and coming back. So thank you.
And is your husband currently able to get the dividend?
He's able to. This was cleared up a few years back. But there was a time period that we didn't file with him because we didn't want our stuff to go in the same envelope and go through whatever it goes through. So
I assume it was fixed by the State Affairs Committee.
It was.
Time.
It was.
We are a good committee. Continue, please.
I have nothing else to present, so unless you have questions for me or...
Any further questions?
The division.
Thank you very much. We have Hillary Martin, Ledge Legal. Are you here someplace, online or in the audience?
Online. Yeah, I'm online.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the State Affairs Committee. Please state your name and make any comments you'd care to make.
Yeah, my name is Hillary Martin. I'm with Legislative Legal Services. I don't have anything to add. If anyone has any questions, I can answer them.
Any questions?
Yeah,
yes. Legal. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hillary, I am, first of all, I want to say I really appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward, and I think it's something that has to be addressed. On page 3, line 23, it prefaces that list with the department shall consider. My question is if it is specific enough. I mean, obviously it leaves the discretion with the department of how they're going to compare, for example, one of those subcut criteria with another one, you know, how many times they've come back, for example, as opposed to how much time they've actually spent in the state and what have you. And I something that Mike just said that really helped me understand that this will actually help the administrative judge by having it one step more firm in statute. But what I'm squirming at a little bit is that it is a subjective nature of the criteria we're laying out, and wondering if that has any ramifications. I'm all for what we're doing, but it's awfully hard to say how far we go in actually setting down the details, you know, of what's good. You know, if they've come back 20 times as compared to somebody else that came back 3 times, you know, and I see it as comparing one person's application with another, you know, where this person came back 20 times maybe to maintain something, his property or whatever. You know, but it's still, it's just, my point is it is very subjective, and I want your feedback, Hillary, from Legal Services, that this law will not lead us into the weeds as far as more court participation, et cetera.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I think the language, just it means the department has to consider all of these factors when they look at an application. I'm not sure how much tighter it can necessarily be. I think every application is different, and so they're going to have to evaluate everyone, and all of these may not apply to everyone, but they have to look. The language means that the department has to look at all of these factors when they're evaluating whether somebody is intending to return and remain in the state.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions at this point? Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, no, sir.
Okay. Representative Keller.
If I could, just to clarify, to make sure I don't make the same mistake that I led us into in the last one, we're considering LS0170/alpha.
Very good.
That is the case. That is the
case. Representative Foggy, do we have anybody else online who would like to testify? Anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Representative Foggy, do you have any closing comments? Are you shaking his head in a negative? With that, I'm going to close public testimony and bring it to the committee for discussion. Anybody on the committee would like to make a comment? Or if not, I'll ask the vice chair to make an appropriate motion.
Can I call an at ease for a second?
Yes. At ease? Come back, Chair. Come back to order. Okay, we've closed public testimony. No further comments, Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller. Do you have any comments or motions?
I have a motion. I would like to comment first that this bill, this is the only committee of referrals, so the next time you'll see it is on the floor. So, but anyway, I would move that we move this bill out of House State Affairs, HB 52 LS 0170 Alpha, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, this bill moves out of committee. Meeting is scheduled for Thursday, January 31st. At that time, we will be considering HB 75 contribution from the PFD, audits in the universe. We're going to stay on the PFD, I guess. And HB 10, executive ethics, legal fees, family travel, and so on. That's for Thursday. We don't have a committee scheduled for the second. You'll be happy to know. And so, any other business to come before the committee? If not, I'd like to thank everybody who participated today. Everybody is welcome to do a co-sponsorship of any bill we heard today if they so choose. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.